All right, so that was a Michael Bivins reference. The guy from Belle Biv DeVoe.
What are you talking about?
The song we were listening to, he said Michael Bivins, and it was a reference to Belle Biv DeVoe, the group that made Poison.
Listen, if there are two things I don't know about, it's music and film.
Tonight on the Brooklyn Film Theorists, we discuss with my special guest, Frank J. Barron. We'll be discussing Cave of Forgotten Dreams, the new 3D movie executed by the master narrative and documentary filmmaker Werner Herzog. After that, we'll take a brief break, play a little bit of music, come back, and discuss the collective works of Werner Herzog. But first, here to play us in our first break, it's Top Dollar Roz, the man. Listen to the man. If you want me to know that you're a fan, but people never let them, I don't give a goddamn. But this thing is what it's giving. It's something I demand. My suggestion is you listen to the man. I'm Papa Joe Jackson. I don't give a fraction. Okay. I want you pay to see like a paralyzed backstab. Welcome to the faction. Let me bring the facts. You don't want drama because I bring the action. Ask them. Top dollars like a Unabomber. I got them all scared in the hotel Rwanda. Trying to survive. I'm suggesting that you hide. I'm performing whack rapper mass genocide. I know that you sick of them. Come and get your medicine. I'm the most feared, revered of all reverence. Because I bring the gospel. And we're back again. That was the song The Man by Top Dollar Roz, our special guest last week on the Brooklyn Film Theorists. He came on to speak about Scream 4. It's a great episode. Go on iTunes, check it out, check out the blog spot. But first, this week, what we're here to discuss is not only the new film Cave of Forgotten Dreams in 3D, which is a major component of the film, Werner Herzog's, but also his collected works. But first, let's talk about the film Cave of Forgotten Dreams. Frank, how did you feel about the film overall, real briefly?
Overall, I love the film. It has a lot of great staples that you find in a lot of his work. There were some things that felt kind of dry and rigid, but under the circumstances, I thought they were very appropriate. Overall, I love the film.
But let's first off, in case, let's say you're not a fan of Herzog and you are still listening at this point, hopefully you are. Werner Herzog, he is best known for being part of the New German Cinema movement that came out of the 60s and 70s in Germany. It was this movement of great young filmmakers who were kind of rising up out of the ashes of German film that was trying to rebuild itself after World War II. And so he was part of that movement, but at the same time, he was very removed from it in the sense that Wim Wenders, Fassbender, these guys, the other people that were involved in the movement, were much more
politically minded.
You could say not intellectual, because Herzog is an incredibly intelligent man.
Well, I wouldn't say that their films weren't intellectual, but
no, I'm not saying their firm. We know Wim Wenders and Rainer Werner Fassbender's films were extremely intellectual. Herzog's are also intellectual. It's just he doesn't like to discuss like the deep, you know,
social context,
theoretical like meaning, that. The social context. He doesn't want to talk about that.
Right.
Those guys wanted to talk about it. They were willing to engage it. He removed himself from that portion of the movement and in a sense removed himself from the movement. And if you think about it long term, that was probably one of his best career decisions because he's still out making movies, 35, 40 years later. And Wim Wenders has had, you know, somewhat of an up and down career. Fassbender died.
He's dead. Yeah.
Yeah. So he couldn't do too much. But there was other people that were part of the movement who have kind of just like segued into other work or just really aren't working anymore. But with Cave of Forgotten Dreams, it's a documentary film. The basic setup is that Herzog joined a group of French archaeologists right. and different artists and everything, and they were allowed to go in this cave. It's the Chevet Cave.
I think it was discovered in southern France in 1994. A small team of archaeologists had discovered it, and since then, since the discovery, it was closed off and secluded to virtually everybody else. So for Herzog to be able to get in there, it was a huge event. Because
how do you think he gets invited to do these things? Do you think he just like reads about it and goes and is like, hey, I'm Werner Herzog. I want to like go in this cave that no one has been in for 10,000 years. Or like, do you think people reach out to him?
For this project, I remember somewhere reading probably on the internet that he had reached out. A ton of other filmmakers, especially French filmmakers, were dying to make this film. he did it somehow through bartering. He actually made this through some French Cultural Commission, where
I saw that it was like a heritage society. They did like some of the funding, and through Channel 4, which is like the British or German television also.
I also,
so there's like multiple, but there's like multiple funding coming in for this film.
Right, right. History Channel, things like that.
Yeah.
A lot of big names backing the film, big companies. But where were we?
No, we were just discussing the synopsis of the film in the sense that,
how he got in there. It was due to a lot of bartering. He actually set it up so that through the French school systems that this film would be available in classes for free as kind of an educational tool. And I think you definitely get that sense when you're watching the film that...
No, it is age appropriate for children too. I saw two children go in with, I guess, maybe their grandmother or someone watching them or something. And the kids came out and they seemed still excited by it, which I could not say about all the adults in the audience, but there was two kids who were definitely into it.
Yeah, I've experienced the same thing.
They go in the Cheviot. How do we pronounce this?
I've heard it right. Cheviot Caves.
So he's given access to these caves. He goes in with this team of archaeologists and everything. And one of the major fascinating things about the film is right from the start, Herzog, who claims not to care about the beauty of his films, but yet always makes beautiful films. He says that, you know, they were only given like four light panels, like big LED light panels. They were given one camera. They were given a crew of four people to hold the four light panels. Yeah, so you can see him holding the light, rotating it. And so we'll discuss later on the look and the lighting of the film, which plays a major component. But first off, he kind of clears that out of the way to say, these were my guidelines. This is what I was working with. And then we had to press on, you know, into the cave to make this movie.
Well, a lot of it is about the restrictions of actually making the film. You know, a lot of it is him getting in there and the circumstances he had to really just explore the space. I mean, you see the way they maneuver through the cave. They have something, it was like a 60 centimeter gap or something like this. It's bigger than that.
Yeah, no, but no, there is like, he talks about it. There's like barely enough room for one person to slide through into the cave.
Right, right.
Yeah, so like they each have to go through that. They get into the cave and then they're on a walkway and you can't leave the walkway. So the cameraman who, I mean, the name is escaping me right now. I saw the film only a few hours ago. He did an exceptional job, obviously, with these zoom lenses because he was forced to stay on the platform and zoom in to the actual cave art. And that's mainly what the film is about. It's not just about the cave that does play a component in it, but it's about the fact that within this cave that was discovered that no one had been in for at least 10,000 years, there are like beautiful cave paintings. And what Herzog is trying to basically say through the film is that these are like the oldest cave paintings that we know about right now.
Currently.
Yeah. Currently, yes. Like from the Paleolithic period, Neanderthals were roaming about. And by painting on these walls,
it's kind of the separation where we, you know, kind of
went from Neanderthal to Cro-Magnon. It was like an evolutionary step. And so one major thing I can already tell, like, critics of Herzog, because they're out there, are going to say about the film is that it's pretentious. Did you feel the film was pretentious at all?
I wouldn't say it was pretentious, no. With the expectations you go into seeing a Herzog film, that being, you know, very eccentric characters, I would say that was... I mean, granted, a lot of it is about limitations. There's limitations in the space. So you also have limitations within the casting. And I know it sounds weird to say casting in regards to a documentary film. But, you know, that's what you're used to. You're used to him pushing the characters and really pulling something out from them. And you don't get that in this film. So if you're going into Cave of Forgotten Dreams with that expectation, you might be let down a bit. I know I did. So it was kind of...
Now, what are you basing this off? I mean, I don't want to go too far into his back catalog, but like, let's talk about some of his other famous
films
documentaries.
Films like recently, I just saw The White Diamond. You know, films like Grizzly Man.
Timothy Treadwell's footage, found footage.
Well, I guess then especially it would be Dieter Dangler and Little Dieter Needs to Fly,
which you just let me borrow, which is an amazing film. Yeah, but Dieter is a very charismatic guy. You could tell. Even on the footage from when he had first come back from Vietnam, which Little Dieter Needs to Fly, it's the documentary that the well-known Hollywood film that Herzog made Rescue Dawn is based on. It's based right. on Little Dieter Needs to Fly.
Right.
So Dieter Dengler was a very charismatic, like good-hearted person, even after he'd escaped from a POW camp, which, I mean, that's like the most extreme position you could be in life, probably.
Yeah, I mean, seeing
that. That or being married. Ooh. Sorry. All
right.
Sorry, I had to break it up for a second. No, but back to the Herzog documentary characters, you are right in the sense that Herzog has control in his documentaries.
Well, oftentimes will manipulate people. I remember seeing the first time I saw Little Dieter Need to Fly, I saw the opening sequence in which, well, Dieter Dengler had spent many months, I think something like 6 months in like a Laos prison. And to, you know, kind of elaborate on his appreciation of freedom, in the beginning of the film, it's like one of the very first sequences you see Herzog. Well, I've read that Herzog asked Dieter Dengler to, when he enters his house, to open the door twice. And then when he closes it twice, and then he tells the camera, you know, he speaks into the camera and he tells him how important it is to be able to, you know, like just how great it feels to be able to open and close a door and just have that kind of freedom.
So, no, you know, what's funny is I was really affected by that part of Little Dieter Needs to Fly. And now that you're telling me Herzog totally manipulated it.
And
it's
that's
like,
what threw me, because I saw that. And once I saw that and you see his character, someone who deals with tragedy. So, I mean,
He handles it so in stride. He seems to just move on in his daily life. Like he was never in a POW camp.
It doesn't affect. And the fact that Herzog makes him go through the camp, you know, like he reenacts it and he's reliving this experience that you would, I mean, going through it, I mean, you can't imagine, but having to relive that in a reenactment, and the way he holds his composure is amazing. And seeing that first clip, knowing that that was fabricated, through the whole film, I found myself looking, you know,
I did not know that about Little Dieter Needs to Fly. See, I was like totally just, wow, this guy is taking this so well. He's so forgiving. He's just an extremely compassionate man. So it does change that. But back to Cave of Forgotten Dreams, what you're getting is you're getting archaeologists.
Right.
You're French getting scientists. You're getting a lot of very dry, boring intellectual types.
They're passionate in the way, you know, all Herzog characters are, but without any eccentricities. You know, they're just dull.
Well, there are like two eccentric characters, but even by Herzog standards, they're pretty boring.
They are pretty boring by those standards.
There's the guy who wears the Inuit cloth. There's a character who like, I think he's supposed to be the crazy scientist.
Oh, well, he's the experimental. It's in quotes. He's the experimental archaeologist. So they don't really elaborate upon what that means, but you get that he's not one of them.
And he plays this flute, and he plays the Star Spangled Banner on it.
Right, yeah. Which is a really great moment in the film.
It is. It's a great moment in the film. And then the other one, the other character that's kind of like the crazy scientist.
The perfumist?
Well, the perfumist is great. There is a scene with this guy who's a perfumist who's trying to smell out a new cave. And then Herzog is able to take him into the cave. And he's just so fascinated in the cave. And the looks on his face, it's just like you're seeing a little kid like opening presents on Christmas Day. That was the impression I got, at least. Did you like the perfumist character?
Going in with the expectations I had, I was kind of still in that mentality that I was kind of put off. You know, I kind of felt like they were almost like, well, not him, but I definitely felt the experimental archaeologist was something, you know, he was looking to place in the film, because, I mean, especially when you see at the end, it's the only film I've ever seen that contains a postscript. You know, Herzog at the end of this film is dying to leave his mark somewhere.
Little Dieter Needs to Fly as a postscript that it says on the screen.
It's
postscript.
A title card.
I'm pretty sure it says postscript.
I
just watched it last night, but I was really tired. So, like, I remember there's some kind of, like, or it's, like, part four or something. And then
Lessons, Darkness, and, like, his other documentaries are broken up. He's got a few of them that are broken up into chapters. But this is the only film that runs, you know, straight through, and then you have a postscript.
Which
and
is coincidentally, yes, like, amazing. I would say the postscript
fantastic.
Is... probably the best part of the movie. I hate to say it. Like, it's...
No, it's not that it's the best part.
In my opinion, it is.
It just elaborates upon the themes of whether or not we are looking... By looking at this cave art, are we looking at a reflection of ourselves? Or at some point, have we departed? And he does that through the mutated crocodile, which he says is actually an alligator. I mean, he just... There's so much, like, glee in him lying, even about a, like a minute detail, well, something like that. He takes such joy. I was listening to this interview where he's talking about like the construction of that scene and the fact that, you know, it wasn't a crocodile.
You ever been to Brooklyn Botanical Garden? There are some weird looking fish in that little pond there. There's this one part where there's like these Asian fish, and there are some that are white and there are some that are red, and the white ones just don't fit in. That's what that reminded me of, because like I was taking pictures of them and I was like really zooming in, really trying to cut through the water, and it's like very dirty water because I hate to say it, but it's Brooklyn and that water is just like putrid green. I'm just saying, I'm like zooming in and you're seeing, and it's like very weird looking fish, and I got that same impression because what they're talking about, the scene with the alligators, is like it's by a nuclear power plant that's like kind of thrown in there at the end. There's just like this
I think he's trying to throw that in there to kind of accentuate the importance of the cave and, you know, how close this nuclear site is. I mean, I don't think nuclear power in particular is, you know,
like he's not saying there's like some kind of leak or anything.
You know, he does say something along those lines.
What I was trying to say is he does insinuate that there's been, like, the mutation of the crocodile.
Right. Well, yeah. It's only an albino crocodile, but, you know, he plays with it.
And he
asserts that it's, like, some sort of mutation. It's an albino crocodile. Most species have, you know, that albino gene.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking to, like, a pasty white guy.
I've had a lot of snakes. As a kid, I had snakes.
Oh, yeah, you're a reptile guy.
I'm a reptile guy.
I forgot that. I forgot you were a reptile guy. So, like, what kind of snakes were just kicking around in your house? Like, what did you have, like, a boa constrictor?
I had several.
At the boa constrictors.
Several boa constrictors, which I tried to breed. I bought these two, a male and female boa constrictor, which both carry genes for albino, where I tried to breed.
So you tried to breed an albino, so that's maybe why you're more forgiving
in
of a scene. You were looking for the pure breed, huh?
I thought the scene was fantastic. I mean, especially the end. Not even that by chance he'd captured this image, because you have this quote-unquote mutated crocodile swimming around in It's like a biodome?
Yeah, it's some kind of tank, because you can tell the guy on the other side, even though he may be submerged in water, is totally isolated from the crocodiles. There's clearly like a glass partition between him and the crocodiles.
All right, so let me,
that they're shooting through.
Let me just make sure I got this right, because this is what I pulled from it, and I want to make sure that it's correct. That what you see at the end is two alligators.
Yes.
You see initially an albino alligator in a container. In this tank within this biodome, and you're not sure whether or not it's one alligator or two beneath the surface.
Yes, because they're mimicking each other.
Right, and their movements are, I mean, they're almost identical, and they pause, and then the camera raises up, and then you see that it's actually two. Whereas first it looks like a mirror image.
And that's he goes on his narration.
And then it's two. So you're looking at it, and, you know, it's in the context of the film, you're looking at it like, you know, are we looking at this cave art, which, you know, I mean, it's so stylized and it's.
But it is very primitive at the same time.
No, I don't think so. I think the contours of the drawing, I mean, it's. I thought it was so fresh.
There's no shadows or anything. It's not like they were building
shadows.
But they're not dealing with like a three-dimensional depth, like the post Renaissance art.
The contours are so defined, and it looks like
they were able to pick up movement and stuff. I got that, but you can't tell me
not
everything is like flattened. It's tableau style. It's like two-dimensional style. They did not understand depth at that point. You can't sit here and honestly tell me, because even the way the skull, when they show the spiritual thing, it's laid out flat. It's not laid out. It's facing the cave, like they put it flat in front of the cave. So it's still like two-dimensional. You would still be looking at it like you would look at a sheet of paper.
I don't think you can say that at all. Just that argument that it's 2D, because, I mean, the majority of the film, they're accentuating the depth of the cave and how.
But if you look at the way the art is, let's say you pop up. And I understand we're doing a podcast. This is like one of the limitations. I can't show you like
what I've I'm seen trying it. To do this is fine for me.
Yeah, but like, let's say you see this wall here. You pop up, and the art moves along in like a straight line. Like, let's say we're here.
Right.
It's moving like this.
Right.
It doesn't go back. There's no depth to the art, so it still is primitive
that's
in that
not
sense.
True. That's not true, because I mean, I remember specifically. There's one image of, I think it's like four horses and you have one consecutively in front of the other. Granted, one is higher, you know, top to bottom, one is higher. But I thought it was pretty clear that you are seeing this in
so you depth. Were saying that there was at least an attempt at, like, they were trying to cover, like,
not even, it's
like
an attempt. When
you
I mean,
it's like when you look at a storyboard,
I think,
and someone
so
doesn't
modern.
Know how to draw depth, you get that, like, same, like, it's like a little kid or something.
I didn't get that at all. I thought the artwork was extremely modern. And you look at, I mean, some of them, like, one of, there's one of two lines in particular, and the contour of it is done so precisely in one stroke, and you look at it and it's so accurate. It's really amazing. And I thought, I didn't get the idea that it looked primitive at all. I thought,
see, I felt like it was, I mean, I appreciated the art. I thought it was very, like, pleasing to look at it. Like, it was aesthetically pleasing, but at the same time, I felt like there was, like, a very rudimentary mindset when it was being constructed. And, like, I understand the layering of it. Like, they discuss this, and this is one of the more fascinating parts to me of the early portion of the film, is when he's discussing something was drawn 5,000 years later.
Right.
It was continued. Well, I mean...
And they only know that through... It wasn't carbon dating.
It was carbon...
What was it? Or
well, no. They did calcite? Some carbon dating, but yeah.
Calcite was that material that covered most of the cave floor. And
yeah.
I think they dated it.
It creates this, like, sparkle. Right. Like, I've seen... I went into – the reason – I got to be honest, and we're going to discuss this more later on when we discuss Herzog in general. But I've been in some caves in Texas, and you can see the stalagmites and some of the calcite, but you can't see too much because, like, as it's discussed in the film, the breathing and everything, the warmth of humans, it wears down the calcite. So you don't really get, like, the full covering when you go to a cave that's often been in by other humans. But by this cave, by the fact that it was closed off, you see all the calcite buildup, and it's kind of beautiful.
Oh, it yeah.
Like, it takes away from the nature, but it's also beautiful in a weird way.
It covers everything. I mean, you have those, you know, bear skulls and all these things, and it's, like, completely encrusted in this fine layer of calcite, which I guess crystal mineral.
Yeah,
it's
yeah, yeah.
It's
but it's I mean, like, if we were scientists right now, I'd be, like, poo-pooing this, but, like, in the context of the film and the way it looked great on camera. Let's talk about the look of the film. We've talked about the restrictions.
Right.
I really like the way they did this thing where, and maybe I'm being, like, pretentious myself, but they, like, would take the light panel and they'd sweep across the cave paintings. And so, like, you wouldn't really see it. And then it would come into view in crisp focus.
You don't really see that so much in the first two-thirds of the film. There's like a first part where Herzog goes in and he's with the archaeologist, but then there's a separate part which is roughly starts at, like, the last third of the film where he goes in by himself, and all the information, you know, all the factual information you're giving, I couldn't make sense of it, because for me, a concept like this art is 32,000 years old means nothing to me. I cannot conceptualize the concept of 32,000 years.
Really? So when, you can't.
Can you? I mean,
yeah, I mean, I can, because if you think – that's what I was trying to do, like, a lot of the movies. I was like, let's say, you know, 2,000 years ago is Christ. Let's just say –
You're big on that? You can conceptualize 2,000 years ago?
Yeah, well, I'm trying to put myself in that mindset. I mean, you really can't, but that's what this film is about. It's about the imagination
I feel like,
of the people who are conceptualizing, because really none of this is proven. We don't know. Like, you can carbon date it, you can call it what you want, but this is still, like – it could be this, or it could be this, or it could be this. Like, have you ever – this is one of the things about, like, a dinosaur. You ever look at a dinosaur? You ever think maybe we put it together incorrectly? We're putting it together based on what we think animals now – like, the
that.
Way animals are now, and then reverting back.
Not even that. A lot of dinosaur skeletons are actually manufactured to look a specific way, to kind of meet that, like, Jurassic Park aesthetic kind of thing. They're
That's
altered.
What I'm saying. But, like, so – if you look at a dinosaur, it could be put together differently. We don't know. We are going off what we know now, and we're going off people with great imaginations to piece it together, who have really, like,
but you know what?
Prestigious
I not,
degrees.
I did not get that. It felt really flat to me, the first two-thirds. And I mean, without that, I don't think I would have been able to appreciate the last third of the film. But I feel like visually Herzog pulls all that together and makes it feel real. Whereas in the first two-thirds of the film, you're seeing the images but you don't see them in the context of the cave. You know, they're all kind of like disjointed. You see them, you've got crew in the shot, and it's hard to connect to what importance there is in this. But in the last segment when he goes in, he really illuminates all that. And it's
beautiful. Did you like the female archaeologist who's, she's kind of just like, she knows the most, but she's so dry. I'll give you that. Like the one who's like, you can't walk any further. She tells him that. You can't walk any farther. So you'll just have to take my word on what I'm saying. I was right. Like, what is this? But then she made some points about they were the primitive people were extremely sexual in nature, which doesn't that make perfect sense when you think about nature in general? That was one of the things I think the movie was like trying to avoid was like how sexual and primitive we still are, like in nature. You know, like they were like Herzog makes a joke about Baywatch. Did you like that right. When they were looking at the old Venuses?
He looks
from
at
like
the Venus of Willendorf. Yeah, exactly. And he talks about how what was important back then sexually is still, you know, what we look for.
Yeah, and he makes a joke about it, but I still think that that says something about like who we are and like how far we've come or how
right.
far we
but
haven't come.
That's I think that's the greatest part of the ending. And I don't even know if we finished talking about the ending. Just the image where. He doesn't wrap it up and he leaves it open because in the same shot you have the alligators that are at first a reflection of one of them and the second they depart. So it's simultaneously both and it's very open-ended and it lets you decide, which I thought was great. And not even that he was able to get that shot, but I think what's great about Herzog as a filmmaker is him being able to pull that out of that image, you know, to pull that theme, that idea out of the image and apply it to the rest of the film.
Well, what theme do you mean? The theme of like...
The separation of how far we've actually come from, you know, Homo sapiens that existed 32,000 years ago in art, you know, motifs that are still reappearing, you know, sexually, all these different, you know, facets of being alive.
Someone poses
a
good point about the term Homo sapiens, thinking man, and they say, what do we know? Like, why do we classify ourselves as knowing back then when we know so little today? And that guy makes an extremely good point. Like,
right, I remember, yeah.
And he says
that.
We should be called, like, homo spiritual or
yeah,
whatever it is.
Yeah.
And how did you feel about that? I know you're not, like, a religious person, but, like.
I don't think it made a great impression on me, but now that I think of it, yeah, I think that was a pretty good moment, a good, you know.
I thought it was
commentary
just,
on it.
And
yeah,
then
it
they show that spiritual
point.
Procession where people were burning charcoal, which could have been used as like, not frangent, incense. You know how like people burn like in Catholic ceremonies.
Was that within the cave?
Yeah, that's when they show
the altar?
Head.
Yeah,
the altar with the head on it facing the cave entrance. And I thought that was such a good point because a lot of art in general, if you look at like real artists, even if it's not spiritual in the sense that they believe in like a god or anything, there is this fact that you don't know what you're doing. You're not fully self-aware when you're doing it, but you're doing it on this like belief that you just have to do it and that it hopefully is good and it will be accepted. And I feel like what he's saying in that part is kind of a statement about his whole career in general. Because Herzog is a guy.
Oh, well, Herzog is really,
yeah.
You know, he considers himself really spiritual. In what sense, I'm not sure.
But
know?
He's like very guttural also in that he shoots from the hip in a way. Like a lot of filmmakers will be like, I want this shot because this represents this.
What do you mean by that?
I mean by like
on
fly
or?
No, I'm just saying like, okay, like they'll use a low angle shot here to represent power and they'll use a high angle to diminish someone, and they'll use these shots and they'll say, I'm going to manipulate the film language to tell a story. But
right.
Herzog is like, I'm not even going to think about that.
Oh,
I'm
right.
going to – I have a story I need to tell.
He's with you
and I'm gonna tell it.
On storyboard specifically.
Yeah, I hate storyboards.
Herzog,
oh, my God.
I was watching,
the death of cinema.
Yeah, I was watching him say that. I mean, you just said storyboards are basically for cowards.
They are. They
right?
are, man.
If you don't have,
I'm so glad I have another person who doesn't like
them. If you don't have
like
the intuition kind of on the spot to know what you need, I mean
– you shouldn't be making movies.
I don't necessarily
agree. You know what? You should be a comic book artist.
But –
and then both Frank and I will not know what you're
right,
referring to.
Right. I don't know what we're talking about now.
Well, what we're going to talk about now is we're going to do a wrap up. What would you give the film on a scale of like 1 to 4 stars?
Oh, I don't know. 1 to 4.
I'm making you give an arbitrary scale. This is what we do.
I don't like this. Brooklyn Film,
we've done theory, and now we have to critique.
I think the film is fantastic. I think anyone with the opportunity to go see it should. I mean, despite having to see it at IFC Center, which you guys aren't endorsed by IFC Center.
No, we're not. Which is terrible. I wouldn't mind it, please.
It's terrible.
Throw some cash our way.
You have, you know, I think it's only one of like five theaters that are currently screening it in the U.S.
All I have to say is this. At the IFC Center, I was just there. There was like cushion coming out in the seat in front of me. Like when I first walked in, I was like, what is going on here? And then I went with Jen. You know, like, I went with my fiance Jen, and she stayed awake. She stayed awake, which, and she really liked it, and she hated Grizzly Man, which we'll discuss later.
My girlfriend was out within 15 minutes of the beginning of Chaos Dreams.
Okay, well,
she got off an early flight, but she was out immediately. I feel a lot of people were out during that film.
We'll talk about this in a second. So, like, but to the experience of the theater, because I'm really into, like, how you watch a movie, Jen leans over and goes, are you comfortable in your seat? And I was like, no. But until you can turn this theater into a better theater, like, I'm going to have to deal with it.
The
like,
seats are the least of IFC Center's concerns. Number one, I think being sound, which...
Yeah, it's pretty poor sound.
It's terrible.
It's poor sound. The screen is too high up for where the seats are located. Like, it was, like, a major issue. Like, the screen should cover you, hopefully, from, like, your feet to your head. Like, I think that's...
Wherever you're sitting, you're looking up.
Yeah, like, exactly. Like, it's just not very comfortable. So anyways, we saw it there, but we did see it in 3D, and I don't know about you, but I felt like my two favorite 3D films of all time are, of course, Avatar and Step Up 3D, which to me, hands head and shoulders above any other 3D, but this would be the third best. How did you feel about 3D?
Besides this, the only other 3D film I've ever seen was Journey to the Center of the Earth 3D with Brendan Fraser, in which I got really drunk and yelled at a child who was really enjoying the film. And I know.
Sorry. That's quite the story.
Yeah. Yeah, but, I mean, it's nothing like that, and, I mean, I can't say it's, well, yeah, it is, like, nothing.
The 3D is, it's like, it makes you think that you could shoot, well, all right, let's put it this way. Cave of Forgotten Dreams does not have any CGI. Avatar was all CGI.
It does have some CGI.
In what scenes?
When they talk about recreating the cave elsewhere, and you have that one French guy, that guy whose job is to redesign the cave visually, you know, as precisely as possible, because somewhere they're looking to make a replica of this to show the people, and I don't know to what degree that would, you know, satisfy anyone.
You know what's funny is I went to see the movie with, I would say, like 50% senior citizens, because I went for a matinee, or I went to a matinee, and... these women, when they heard that there was going to be, like, a cave recreation for tourists, this woman that was sitting next to me was like, she made this noise.
Is that
she
a
was
positive
like,
or
she
or
was
negative?
Like totally disgusted by modern society.
She
like,
couldn't deal
with
it.
Yeah, she was just like,
she had to let you know.
Oh my God. You know, it's like all these sounds came from this woman. And I was just like, lady, I feel you, but I don't need to say it, like, in the theater.
She wanted you to know.
Yeah, well, I wanted her to, like, know it to herself. Like, I'm really enraptured in this, like, great 3D film. And, like, the other thing is those glasses.
Oh, like, those were terrible. I wasn't sure if there was, like, fingerprints on them the whole time. I kept having to clean them.
No, and then I pulled my glasses, like, off my nose a little, and I could see my own eyes, and I was just scared.
It was not a great experience, but the fact, I mean... film is so good, it makes it worth it.
So you still haven't answered. I would give this film, I'm caught between a 3 and a 3.5.
Yeah, 3.5, I would say. If I had to, 3.5.
Because it's just so beautiful. The music is incredible. The music is incredible.
It almost makes the entire film. It's fantastic.
And Herzog is, he's very open about how much he uses music to help tell the story. Like, he really, like, relies on it. He doesn't shy away from it. He's not like one of these, like, oh, I could tell the story silently, but, you know, like, he's not going out there. So, for you, though, as the archaeologist, I kept it from being a 4. Like,
not having those characters that I'm so accustomed to. I mean, if you haven't seen his films before, you probably won't even notice. But if it's something you're looking for, you're not going to get it.
Yeah, that's true. And, I mean, one thing about Cave of Forgotten Dreams, the other thing is it starts slow. I mean, this film, much like all of Herzog's work, builds... And I think it builds to just a beautiful conclusion that really makes you think. If you leave Cave of Forgotten Dreams and you're not thinking about just like life as it is now versus life then versus where we are headed, all these different things. If you're not thinking about when you leave this film,
see it again.
Yeah. See it again. Well, no, there's that. Not only are you not probably a Herzog fan, then you should probably just go right now and buy Fast Five tickets and just go watch that, because
is that also screening at IFC? You could go.
It isn't, but I still want to see Fast Five. Do you want to see Fast Five?
I don't even know.
That's what Mark and I will be talking about. And Mark, I can't wait till we get to do one of these again. That you come back to the booth, but we're gonna take a break. You get 3.5 stars.
3.5, definitely.
Right. You ready to talk about some more Herzog?
Sure.
All right, nice. All right, first off, we've got a musical break. We're going to be doing a song by OISD. It's a New York City rap collective group. They've got a new album out on Bandcamp, and here's one of their songs. Here we go.
Shit, it's your highness. It's a kid Touche, rolling with the finest. IQ Blue and J.O. on the high tip. You're messing with the crew, then we flex like a bicep. I guess hype you when I step into my Nikes. Leaders of the true, we the residential hype piece.
And there's just this finality to it where you start and you have to keep going, and you hopefully catch a fire, and it just
What are you talking about?
No, it's just, once you're on, it's live, so you just go with it, and you just hope that it creates
this good
conversation.
Let's just finish this.
What, am I keeping you up here? Like, what, are you all right? Oh, okay. We're back. That was OISD, Sidekicks and Fly Kicks. The group has a new EP out. It's on Bandcamp.com. It's got Houston and Fifth. If you're from the South, it's Houston and Fifth. We'll just leave that one alone, since I don't really understand New York pronunciation sometimes. Anyways, I'm back with Frank J. Barron, star of, and we're discussing Herzog, Werner Herzog's films. We just touched on Cave of Forgotten Dreams. Now we're going to discuss his work as a whole. And in general, Frank, which do you prefer, Herzog's documentaries or his narrative films?
Do you think
there's much difference?
Right, there's not, which is kind of what makes it kind of difficult to answer, but my favorite Herzog film is probably Lessons of Darkness, for that very reason, that there's so much manipulation going on and there's so much alteration. And he basically captures the burning of oil fields during the Kuwait War from, you know...
Wait, the Iraq War or the Kuwait War?
Kuwait.
But wasn't that like... that was pre-Desert Storm.
Listen, I don't know.
All right, I'm sorry. I'm just trying to put it in a context where people will know what the hell we're talking about.
So was that a war?
The Kuwait War, it might have been a war. I just think that it was pre-Desert Storm. Is when Iraq went into Kuwait and burned down their oil fields. Because Kuwait is just all oil. Yeah.
Because a lot of what you just said appears in the film visually.
Yes.
All right, that's the film I
like. And it's filmed beautifully over, like, beautiful opera music.
Oh, it's great. Well, it's filmed in this very wide-angle lens, I'm assuming from a helicopter, a lot of aerial photography.
Yeah, it's a lot of aerial photography.
And, I mean, it's just, like, so foreboding. And the footage is so dark. And the thing I like best about it is that he has this footage that he shot, but he manipulates the whole thing in creating, taking the war and using it kind of as a microcosm for, you know, like a post-apocalyptic future where this is the surface of the Earth. This is what Earth looks like. And in the film, he's got just my favorite examples of, you know, the theme of madness, which he's always touching on, where you have these firefighters. They look like...
Well, wait a minute.
They barely
human. You're going to say Herzog's, and I'm not disagreeing with you. Obviously, he's obsessed with the madness of man, and who is really mad? Is it the person who, like, bourgeois society considers mad, or is it the outsider?
Usually he uses a protagonist to comment on society. Yeah. I mean, this is he's showing the madness. Well, I guess I mean in a film like Strozek or something like that.
Well, I was gonna say in Cave of Forgotten Dreams, who represents the madness?
I don't even consider that an element of the film. Really,
I would say it's modern man.
Well, you know what? I guess
he was saying modern society. There's something so wrong with modern society that in like a year, like if you started a painting. 1 year from now, would I be able to complete that? Would I be able to carry that on?
Well, I didn't pick that up from that idea.
Okay, but I'm asking you to think about this, though, right now, like, on the spot. You see, what he talks about is one person or one, you know, like, one person painted something, and then 5,000 years later, someone else, totally unremoved from that situation, potentially, like, a different tribe, a different way, maybe they've evolved even, going back and continuing that painting. Something like that could never happen today is what he says.
That's not what I got from it.
Then what do you, so you don't feel like there's any discussion of like madness on
the part? Well, I think the only madness comes from the postscript, just this idea of, you know, that we're putting up these things. I mean, knowingly or unknowingly close to the site, you know, the Shavit Caves, just the idea that we could put something over. That's the only thing I think even like hints at it. I
feel like there's like some subtextual stuff he's saying about modern society that like we could start something and then like minutes like, later we couldn't even finish it.
But no, I think it's kind of the opposite thing, that it's finished over such a large period of time. And I mean, unless you were told, you would never know, you know?
But he says he brings up that same number. It's not just like an arbitrary number. He brings up 5,000 years from now, would this crocodile look back at the cave and what would it think of the cave? What would the crocodile, let's say the crocodile has taken over and evolved over man, what would the crocodile think of the cave? And he says 5,000 years. He doesn't say 35,000.
Well, that I don't think I could tell you.
Do you think that's just a coincidence that he chose 5,000? That he chose that number. Do you think that's just a coincidence?
You know, I haven't really even considered that before. Now, I kind of, when I saw that, I mean that got I think one of the biggest laughs in the theater when I saw it. I kind of read it as a joke.
I don't know. I mean, I think there's some humor behind it, but I think like behind every joke, there's like a certain amount of.
Well, what did you pull from that then?
What do you mean? The fact
when he specifies on it being 5,000 years.
I took from it that he was saying that like, you know, in 5,000 years, like modern man wouldn't be the one to go back to the cave and continue the drawings of the cave. That it would be someone else, a mutation of man. Like, man has contaminated not only these crocodiles, but, like, humankind in general,
right,
yes,
right.
To a point that we will not be the ones who are continuing the cave drawings.
Right, right.
Yes, and that was what I got from the moment. Maybe
right.
I'm, like,
you know,
postulating
what?
And looking over when I need to.
No,
but.
I think that's probably pretty spot on. Just probably something I didn't pick up on at the time. Are you icing me on
your
podcast?
I'm icing you on air. I'm doing the first on-air icing in the history of podcasts. You got to do it. You got to do it right now. Mike, are you familiar with icing? Do you know what it is?
No.
All right. Icing.
Why don't you explain?
Icing is when someone is given a Smirnoff Ice, and they have to get down on one knee, and they have to drink the Smirnoff Ice, which is, like, just terrible. It's really citrusy, like... I mean, girls used to like it in high school, and they have to get down on one knee, and they have
Mark,
to drink drink all the Smirnoff Ice.
I sincerely hope that Mark kills you for ruining the integrity
of the
show,
podcast.
Making
yeah,
me sick.
No, I mean, I've always wanted to do an on-air icing. I did one at the end of a film shoot I did like 6 months ago, where we iced the sound guy, and it just really worked. And the other thing was, Frank doesn't remember this, but he iced me with a 22-ounce Smirnoff Ice when we were out at a bar one night, and it got me really drunk, and I went home, and I was just, like, obliterated, and I've never forgiven Frank, and so this is revenge. I'm sorry you had to witness this, Mike. All right. Are you okay, Frank?
That was terrible.
I'm crying. You're crying on the inside, or, like, you're physically tears streaming down your eyes?
Tears.
All right. Back to the podcast.
Oh, wow.
So, okay, I just wanted to discuss, like, one of Herzog's major themes being, like, the madness of man and relating it to Cave of Gun Dreams.
Let me just say one thing that I think Lessons of Darkness, and if you could get a hold of it, you should definitely check it out, has one of the greatest examples, I think, through all of his work. It's just a scene where you have these these men who go around, I mean, and this is the surface of the earth. It's just burning oil fields. And you have these men who are walking around distinguishing these fires as it's their only purpose.
You mean extinguishing them?
What did I say?
You said discerning them, making them seem more proper than they are.
Right, discerning one fire from another.
Anyway, they're like putting out the fires, but really what they're doing in the movie is just watching them burn.
They put them out. They exhaust all this effort to put them out. And there's just this great scene, which, I mean, is totally taken out of context. You have this guy who's smiling. He's one of these guys. And then you see them relight, for some reason, one of the fires. And he uses it as this idea that man has just lost, you know, every sense of reality. And the only purpose they have is to go around and extinguish and relight these fires. And I think it's beautiful.
No, this is one of the things we can definitely agree on. I've told you one of the scariest moments of my childhood. I hate to retell the story since I've already told it to you before. But I had to watch this thing. I don't know if it was like Reading Rainbow or one of those educational programs where they showed people working on the Golden Gate Bridge. And what they said was they work on it all year. And then when they're done, they start over and they work on it again. And then I'm from New Hampshire, and our only real landmark in New Hampshire was the Man in the Mountain. And there were people who just constantly worked on the Man in the Mountain. And as a kid, I just remember being like, wow, so these people, the whole existence is doing something until it's complete and then doing it over again because it's never complete. And that to me was like the scariest thing. It really freaked me out. And that's what Lessons of Darkness kind of is saying about the madness of man. Like, we're doing something. We're doing it over. We're doing it over. And then is we're stripping it all down again just to do it over again. Like, they're putting out the fire only to relight it.
Right.
Yeah. That's terrible. I mean, that's scary if you think about it.
Yeah. I mean, it's just completely irrational. And it's just – it's horrifying. And I think – I mean, just as, like, over his filmography that you see that theme reoccurring, for me, that is, you know
– What's your favorite Herzog movie?
Articulate Point.
You say Lessons of Darkness?
I want to, but I don't know if I don't know. It's really difficult. You know, I haven't seen the full filmography.
Because he's made like 50 films.
Aguirre's up there for sure.
What do you think? Aguirre's better than Fitzcarraldo?
That's
See, for me, Fitzcarraldo, which it's the movie that's notoriously known for in the plot, the character Fitzcarraldo wants to build an opera house. And he makes these like native people of Peru drag a boat over a mountain. And to make the film, he really had the film crew and the extras drag a boat over a mountain. This film is known for this. And to me, the film, it's a great film anyway, but the fact that he pulls it off, it's just, it's incomparable to anything else you'll ever see. And for, to me, like, I think that's his greatest achievement. I think, that's his greatest achievement.
That's where I think it kind of gets... It's hard to talk about because, you know, are you discussing your favorite film or are you discussing Herzog's favorite, you know, greatest achievement?
This is his greatest achievement, but it's not my favorite film by him. My favorite film is Strozek.
Is it really?
And you know why? It's because that movie affects me on an emotional level that, like, I'll admit it, it, like, pulled my hoe card. Like, it really, like, affected me emotionally. Like, probably wasn't the best wording right then, but it really cut to the bone. You know what I mean? Like, and I did not like The Enigma of Caspar Hauser. I'm very open about this.
I have no clue.
Because I think it, like, posterializes it. It dumbs down the audience by making the audience feel so intellectual. To me, that movie is for people who want to feel smart. Because when they watch a movie like that, they're like, I get it. I feel smart after. Because you get it. You get what's going on. But a movie like Strozek, there's a lot bubbling under the surface that's never overtly spoken about. And that's why the ending, it has that famous ending that you can go on YouTube.
Oh, the dancing chicken.
Look up the dancing chicken. It will make no sense. Then go back and watch the movie. And it's like heartbreaking when you've seen the movie. But if you watch it out of context, it's just like scary and silly.
It's so bizarre. The whole end sequence is just, it's... It's absurd. It's,
but did you like the movie? Are you a fan of it?
Oh, I loved it, yeah. I thought it was great.
I love it. All right, let's go through. I mean, we're on a limited amount of time here. We could talk about Herzog all day.
The one thing that's really important to discuss is
Bad Lieutenant. Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans. Not Bad Lieutenant, Abel Ferreira and Harvey Keitel. I love that movie.
It's not a remake.
Stop saying it's a remake, people. It's not a remake.
It's not.
It stars Nicolas Cage, one of the best actors of, I mean, I wouldn't say it's just our generation. I would say it's all film.
You're being sarcastic. Okay, yeah.
I'm 100% serious.
Oh, I can't tell. Because, I mean, I don't hate Nick Cage. I like Nick Cage. I think he's Nicolas a good actor Cage when is he's crazy, utilized well. But,
In Bad Lieutenant, and it's on phenomenal. Netflix instant. You have no excuse not to watch it. Go on there. Watch a movie that pushes the boundaries of what a film can be. And I don't mean that in the, like, artsy, like, you know, all these, like, super long takes for no reason. All this, like, you know, montage filmmaking. None of that. What I'm talking about is a movie that's funny and dramatic and sad and it like holds a mirror not to just like the South, which I have to admit I've been in New Orleans. I lived in the South. I really like that because he really captures it for being a German director. But just like what America stands for in general, like what is lionized in America? Did you feel that way?
Not having any previous experience in the South, I don't know.
I think it really nails the location. I think Exhibit is exposed as being like one of the worst actors in the film, and he's still not bad.
Right, he's not bad.
He's decent. He's decent. Not. He just doesn't have a Southern accent, whereas the people around him seem to.
I mean, Port of Call. I mean, before I saw Port of Call, I saw Aguirre and I think Grizzly Man, and I saw both of those films. And Port of Call is what really, you know, pulled me into wanting to see the rest of Herzog's filmography and really getting me interested in his work.
See, I feel the same way. How could you say, because we discussed earlier that Frank believes he's the one that made me want to see Herzog movies.
It's definite. That's what happened.
That's not what happened.
But regardless, the iguana scene is what pulled me in.
Have you seen Port of Call? You're going to have to see it, Mike. Sorry. You're going to have to see it. It's on Netflix, man. You have no excuse.
It's just such an absurd. I mean, within the context of the film, you have one of Herzog's new, you know, like, I mean, what other major Hollywood films has he made?
Rescue Dawn. And that's the one everyone knows, which I have not seen. I want to see, especially after seeing Little Dieter Needs to Fly.
Is there anything besides that?
I mean, most of his modern work is known, but Port of Call, New Orleans was a Hollywood film, you know, budgeted. Like, it has a decent budget.
And the things he manages to sneak into this film, and especially, I mean, you're looking at a 2-minute shot of two iguanas. One's not an iguana, one's a
There's bearded, a huge flare on the lens. One, it doesn't cut together. One is overexposed. One shot is overexposed with a flare. The other shot is perfectly exposed. And somehow you buy the fact because makes you believe that it's in Nicolas Cage's head.
That, and I mean, it's shot, it's silly. It's such a silly shot. You have these like distorted iguanas in extreme close-up. And I mean, especially within the context of the film, you know, using this really cheap, like, home camera, it's just such a bizarre effect.
Whereas a lot of the film is shot in Super 35. So you're getting this mix of, like, high-quality image with, like, low-quality DV.
Right, and it's just such a jarring effect because it looks like just a, you know, just like
a
Hollywood
production. What about Eva Mendes in that movie? She's solid. People always want to cut her down. And the mom, Stifler's mom.
She's okay. She's good.
Both of them are... Dude, both of them are solid. They're both solid in that film.
And not even that. He's got great extras in that game.
He's got Michael Shannon as the guy in the drug room. I mean...
Munt,
yes. Like, oh, God. I feel like we could talk about Port of Call all day.
An excellent movie. If you get the chance to see Port of Call, you have to
I feel like Nicolas Cage's performance... And you know what's funny? I was listening to... I'm a huge fan of the Sports Guy podcast. It's a sports podcast. But he was talking to Adam Carolla, who they're both really funny. And they were talking about Nicolas Cage, and they were really cutting him down. And they were like, his only movie that's really high on Rotten Tomatoes is Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans. And it got over an 80%. And then they just glossed over that. Like, always had 1 out of 9. But when you have one movie that is just... You're so amazing in. Like, there's a scene... I have to bring it up because I love it, where an older woman opens the door to her hotel room and she wheels in and she turns around and Nicolas Cage is holding an electric razor shaving in the room, and it's so menacing but so funny.
His character is horrifying.
It's so funny.
He's like so lanky and like it's almost like a Nosferatu.
And he has that like crazy balding like haircut.
Yeah, and he's just sitting there and he's shaving in the corner.
He's shaving behind the door.
But it's so menacing at the same time because he's threatening the woman.
Very scary.
Yeah. So, I mean, to me, and the reason we had to bring this up is because there's the Bad Lieutenant Port of Call New Orleans recently was referred to as a cult film. And I feel like for something to be a cult film, it has to be a failure. And I feel like that film was a success then. I've talked about it when it first came out because I saw it in the theaters by myself. I loved it. Everyone else in the theater, I felt, loved it. And I just feel like it's one of like the great modern films. It is a comedy that has dramatic parts.
Definitely.
And I think people took it for an art film. Like, they wanted to go in and watch this, like, super dramatic film, and it's not that.
I think, I mean, there are moments that, you know, kind of allude to that, but I think it's, I wouldn't call it an art film by any means. I mean, it's otherwise pretty conventional.
All right, we got to wrap up. Give people, let's say someone has made it this far, they're not a Herzog fan, start naming some Herzog films that they should go see. Just go anything that comes to your mind.
Well, first of all, I would say definitely Lessons of Darkness is a great film to see. It's short, it's 40 minutes. It's a lot of montage stuff like that. If you can appreciate the aesthetics of it, you'll definitely love it.
If you like opera music too, exquisite use of just incredible opera music. Wagner, yeah, especially a lot of Wagner.
I'm trying to think of just, I mean, all the things I've seen recently. Great documentary, The White Diamond.
Really? I haven't seen that.
I've just seen that recently. I have to tell you. Andrew recommended that to me. I thought it was great. It was excellent. I don't know. I haven't seen a film that has disappointed me yet. I've maybe seen almost 15 of his films.
My only Herzog movie I've seen two that have disappointed me. My Son, What Have You Done, which I saw in theaters, which came out only months after Bad Lieutenant. And again, I can't tell you how much I really like Bad Lieutenant. I saw My Son. There are some incredible moments.
Right,
it's just not a great whole film.
I don't know
and then
if it's
Enigma
enough to
Casper
sustain
Hauser.
You. They're sitting all.
Everyone bows down at the Herzog altar for Enigma Casper Hauser. I think it's one of his weakest films. I would say see it, but I don't think it's anything to write home
about. You should
definitely
see it.
But I would say like Aguirre is better. I would say Fata Morgana is better. I would say Grizzly Man, which for me, when I first saw Grizzly Man, I was incredibly impacted by that. If you don't like Grizzly Man, I understand it's not for everyone, but the people that laugh at the ending, I don't know. I just don't get it. I don't get it. It's like an extremely emotional film for me. And the fact that someone tried to tame nature, I understand that's like...
That's like a huge theme in his work, you know?
Yeah, but I mean, the fact that they did and they failed is one thing. But at the same time, this is a guy, Timothy Treadwell, the main character who loved life and just loved people. And he really thought he was doing something important. So for people to minimalize him by thinking it's a comedy, it's like I think they're really missing the whole point of the film and probably life in general.
Well, I'm not going to comment on Grizzly Man. My memory of it's kind of hazy, but I'm glad that's how you feel. I'm glad that you like Grizzly Man.
Oh, man. All right. Well, this has been it's a long episode, but I feel like it was a good episode. Frank, thank you for coming on.
Thank you.
Discussing
thank you
Herzog.
For icing me.
Oh,
show?
Yeah, we did the first live on-air icing. I want to thank Mike Black. Mike, you've got an EP coming out. You've got an album coming out. He's got shows coming out. It's MicBlaque. Mike Black. You find him on Twitter. You find him on Facebook. It's Brooklyn Film Theorist. Go on iTunes. If you like what you hear, subscribe. Let us know how you feel. You think we can make it better, let us know. And to play us out for the evening, we have The Man by Top Dollar Roz. Here we go.
I'm the most feared, revered of all reverence. Cause I bring the gospel, brand new testament. It's one sentence long, it don't please long, this not end.
You see, I go, 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 go,
if you want, but you know that you a fan, but on a really though, I don't give a goddamn, but respect is what is given. It's something not demand, my